1980 CQ. CQ means certified question from the Federal Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and it's James Hanlon versus the Town of Milton and Joseph S. Good. He is representing James Hanlon. Mr. Good.
May it please the court. My name is Joseph Good. I'm associated with the Milwaukee law firm Kravitz, Gass, Hovel, and Leitner. I represent the certified appellant in this case, James D. Hanlon. This morning I'm joined in the courtroom by my colleague, John Hovel, who sits to my right, as well as by my client, Jim Hanlon. I would ask Jim if you could briefly stand for the court so they get to know who you are. This morning the court is asked to look at a very narrow issue of state law, a question of first impression involving procedure. And that procedure and that question is whether or not, under Chapter 68 of the Wisconsin statutes, Mr. Hanlon could have and should have brought his equal protection claim at the time he brought his certiorari proceedings. I would suggest to the court this morning the answer to that question is no, and that the certified question should be returned to the Seventh Circuit and answered in the negative. My reasons for that are drawn plainly from the statute and the language that's contained within Chapter 68. That plain language, unequivocally and unambiguously, requires that that certified question be answered in the negative. And in particular, I turn the court's attention to two provisions of Chapter 68. First, WSSTAT 68.001. Statute that defines what Chapter 68's purpose is all about. That purpose is defined by the statute on the plain face of it. It says that it is meant to remedy and protect the rights of specific persons which are entitled to due process protection under the 14th Amendment. Now, the language of the statute that the Seventh Circuit struggled with is actually what I think this court needs to struggle with and what we should talk about today, and that's found in WSSTAT 6803.9. And that's the exception language, the notwithstanding quote that the Seventh Circuit talks about in its decision from this summer. That exception language is pretty clear to me. It says, except as provided in 6802, the following determinations are not reviewable under this chapter. And then there's a list. And the last one on the list says, notwithstanding, or in other words, in spite of any other provision of this chapter, any action or determination of a municipal authority which does not involve the constitutionally protected right of a specific person or persons to due process in connection with the action or determination. Besides the notwithstanding language, I think the operative language there is does not involve the constitutionally protected right of due process, because that's equal protection. The argument that has been advanced by the town of Milton in this case necessarily ignores that plain reading of Chapter 68. Our take on that chapter and on the certiorari proceedings that are allowed under that chapter in the judicial review is that it is meant to serve as a procedural check, a safeguard, to ensure that a person like Mr. Hanlon, who has been aggrieved by a municipal determination, has had at least a fair shot at saying, this is what happened to my application, and making sure that that person got a fair hearing. It is a limited remedy. It is drawn from common law originally, but has been codified in Chapter 68. In Chapter 68, the legislature now has specifically said how limited it is, and I suggest to the court that it's about due process.
So in a nutshell, your argument is that he's got to bring any due process claims, but he cannot bring equal protection claims.
Exactly. And I think that their argument wholly ignores that. And what they attempt to do in their argument, the respondents attempt to do, is relegate equal protection to some type of secondary status. And I don't think that's good enough for our Constitution, either in this state or the United States Constitution. It's a separate animal. It's treated as a separate clause under the 14th Amendment. It's subject to different types of proof and different types of requirements. And this court, in construing a statute, even if somehow the court were to disagree with me and consider this statute to be somewhat ambiguous, is guided by the principle that when something specific, like due process, is mentioned in the statute, it is presumed in an interpretation of that statute that the exclusion of other alternatives is a deliberate view of the legislature that they meant to exclude it. And I think that's what's going on here. The meaning of due process is clear. It is not equal protection. It is different.
Does anyone else want to?
Just said the magic word.
It's not so clear to me. When I think of the words of arbitrary and capricious, are those the magic words, and those invoke equal protection, is that correct? And those are the findings of the trial. Those words speak to me of not having a fair hearing, which suggests to me due process violation. So can you assist me in clarifying that or helping me get it clarified? It seems like the due process and equal protection are intertwined.
Is your argument just...
I have no argument. Okay. I'm asking.
Is your proposal, though, Justice Bradley, that equal protection is somehow subsumed by due process considerations?
Well, at least shaded in.
You can call it equal. When a board acts in an arbitrary and capricious manner, that's been defined as a violation of equal protection. Why can't that also be defined as a denial of due process? Because if they operate in such a fashion, you have not had a fair and impartial hearing.
Well, I think, you know, on its face, that's a good point. The problem with it is you have to look at the nature of the remedy that's been provided for under Chapter 68 and the limitation of that remedy. Under the civil rights claim that's pending in the federal court, we had to show an intentional act, we had to show discrimination, we had to show that Mr. Hanlon was similarly situated to other people, and then, and this is the kicker, we had to show that that intentional discrimination was brought about by some type of improper motive. Things that the hearing examiner and the circuit courts in Rock County never could look at because of the limited nature of what certiorari is all about. There was no development of those types of facts. And let me give you an example. While this court is obviously not here to address the merits of Mr. Hanlon's equal protection.
Before you get into an example, are you saying that an equal protection claim requires the showing of an intentional act, improper motive, discriminatory action, similarly situated, whereas due process does not?
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that the due process clause guarantees if you have a property right at interest, that some process is due, and then it's up to the courts to decide what level of process is due. That's what I think the due process clause says.
Counsel, I don't want to quibble over the facts, but when I read the facts in this case, those were the facts that you just cited, which were in the debate about whether or not your client would have this gravel pit. I mean, was this arbitrary, capricious? Was he treated differently? Other people got the permit. He didn't. They didn't even have need to have any testimony, et cetera, et cetera. Those were the facts. And now you're saying that wasn't fully developed. I don't quite understand that argument.
Justice Wilcox, let me see if I can maybe explain a little bit further. And I think you raise a good point because you've read the Court of Appeals brief from the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, where we talk about the fact that Mr. Frederick and Mr. Clark, who are the targeted defendants with respect to the equal protection claim, received permits that night on February 19th of 1990, almost 10 years ago. But that is a far cry from a general assertion of this happened in a Chapter 68 proceeding to proving that it was done with some invidious, improper motive, which I don't think we could look at. Chapter 68 speaks in the singular. It talks about a municipal determination, not the review and analysis and comparison which you necessarily have to do in an equal protection case of multiple determinations. In other words, under defendant's theory of what we should have done back in 1990, the Rock County Circuit Court and the hearing examiner necessarily would have had to accomplish an exhaustive analysis, application by application, to make out the equal protection argument. And it simply wasn't advanced, it wasn't allowed, and it wasn't done. The focus of the Chapter 68 proceeding in Mr. Hamlin's case was whether or not Mr. Hamlin's application complied with the Town of Milton's ordinance. And that's a different animal.
Now, would you have to go outside the record to prove your equal protection?
In the Chapter 68 case, absolutely.
And I mean,
that's
your
point
our about certiorari.
Right.
It's limited to the record.
Absolutely, Chief Justice Abramson. And I think yesterday, as I sat and watched this court's review of the Thorpe case, Justice Sykes said it best when she said certiorari is about looking at an administrative record. I'm sure you remember that, to whoever it was you were asking. The point is, you're looking at a contained record that wasn't fully developed. There was not the full-blown discovery procedures that the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure allowed. For instance, and let me give you an example of a couple of facts. And again, I don't want to get into the merits here because that's not why we're here today. But the reality of the matter is, until we filed our federal lawsuit, we didn't know that Gerald Frederick had obtained $325,000 or $330,000 worth of economic benefit from the fact that he sat on the Planning and Zoning Committee and Mr. Hamlin did not. I think that's an important fact. Circumstantial. They're entitled to put in their proof that they had a proper motive for doing what they were doing, but we are entitled to put in the proof that it was an improper motive. And that's the point, is that the record was contained, and while it's fine to say, generally, we were treated unfairly, we were treated arbitrarily and capriciously, and we lost that battle. We'll accept that. But the point is, under the guise of Chapter 68, we didn't have a full opportunity to develop those equal protection claims and the facts of those claims. And that's what we're arguing for today.
Is there a different remedy that you are able to get under equal protection as opposed to due process? Damages, money damages, whatever?
Absolutely. And you raise another good point, which has been asserted in our brief. It's a different animal. All that the circuit court could do under Chapter 68 is affirm, reverse, or modify. So the Chapter 68 proceeding is solely about whether or not the permit should have issued. That's it. The equal protection case is about money. It's about damages. It's about saying, I have been injured because my civil rights have been violated. And that's an entirely different creature. Now, let me see if I can talk about
that. But due process could give you money, too.
Sure. And as the court probably is aware, we asserted a due process claim in the Seventh Circuit, which we ultimately dropped on appeal, choosing instead to focus on what I think this thing is really about, and that is the unequal treatment of Mr. Hamlin.
Did you have to drop it because under Chapter 68, that should have been brought up in cert?
Well, that wasn't an argument that was advanced by the defendants, but in my reading of how this court perceives the Thorpe case and what the Thorpe Court of Appeals did, I think that's an accurate interpretation on the due process element. But let's not forget, the Seventh Circuit has basically said that the United States Supreme Court's decision in Williamson doesn't necessarily apply to equal protection claims so long as it's a bona fide equal protection claim. And I suggest to you the facts here clearly show that a jury could look at the motive behind what was decided two different ways.
Now, I take it you are familiar with the Court of Appeals decision in Thorpe.
Yes, generally, yes.
Does the procedure that you have taken, is that procedure consistent with the Court of Appeals opinion?
I think it is, because basically we are allowed to proceed with a separate claim. We didn't have to come into state court and ask for our state law remedies to protect our equal protection rights. Because I don't think, again, Chapter 68 allows for that, number one. But number two, we didn't have to do it. In other words, we could have just run into court. And that brings me, Justice Babich, to what I think are the real policy issues that this court in its institutional role has really got to decide here. And that is whether or not this court wants to invite the type of protracted litigation, joining all of these claims together, bringing in a claim for damages, all that good stuff at the get-go, or allowing this extraordinary remedy of certiorari to run its course, see what happens, and then allow the litigant to make a decision. Now, in response to that, the respondents say, oh, well, you know, you're going to have multiple litigation, and the reason that we have claim preclusion is to prevent that, vexatious lawsuits and inefficiencies in judicial economy. I submit to you, members of the court, that the better argument for judicial economy lies with the approach that Mr. Hanlon took. Because as a matter of practice, advising Mr. Hanlon or anybody else in a situation like this, you're going to have a situation where if Mr. Hanlon would have gotten that permit, there would have been no federal lawsuit. He would have gone on his way and done what he wanted to do, and that is quarry gravel and try to make money off of his land.
I'm going to show my ignorance on this question.
Sure.
I'm going to ask the question anyway. Does Chapter 68 allow for money damages?
No. No. It's only a review of the record. Again, I think it's 68.13.1 that says affirm, reverse, or modify.
Even if you bring a due process claim under Chapter 68,
right,
you cannot get money damages for a violation of due process.
That's right. And that gets into this whole joinder argument that's been advanced by the respondents. And maybe, Justice Babbage, this is a good stepping off point to discuss that joinder argument so we can look at it. Well, I think the joinder theory that's been advanced in their brief goes beyond what this court has been asked to look at under the certified question. I think it's important that we talk a little bit about the policy so you see where I'm coming from. And I pose the following hypothetical as an illustration of how I think or why I think joining of all of these claims that they say we should have joined back in 1990 makes no sense, certainly not from a judicial economy sense. Let's assume that a litigant like Mr. Hanlon filed a certiorari, was aggrieved by a municipal determination. And let's assume that that litigant files in Rock County Circuit Court and asserts Chapter 68 and does what the respondents are saying he should have done, files an equal protection claim pursuant to 42 U.S.C. 1983. Now, I don't know a defense lawyer worth the price of their law degree that isn't going to remove that case immediately based on the federal questions presented under the equal protection claim to federal court. That's the reality of what happens if you adopt the joinder theory that they're advancing, I think.
Why would we do that?
Well, if you're looking at it from, at least in this court, in the perspective of the Seventh Circuit, which certainly, and I mean this respectfully, hasn't been a friend of land use cases in the federal courts, if you are a defense lawyer, that's where it's going to go. I think that's the choice, the strategic choice you would make is remove. And if you follow my hypothetical through, I think that there are three constituencies that are going to be frustrated by that. One is the federal court, one is this court, and one is the Wisconsin legislature. Let me tell you why. There's a case that is not cited in the state briefs to this court, but was cited by the respondents in their Seventh Circuit brief called Muckaway. It's often cited by municipalities in these land use cases because it's one of Judge Easterbrook's decisions where he says, it is not the function of federal district courts to serve as zoning appeals boards. Availability of federal review of every zoning decision would only serve to further congest an already overburdened federal court system. So that's what he would have to say about this removal that would occur. And I think what proceeding on the plan that I've suggested, allow the state court Chapter 68 proceeding to run its course. Get those details out of the way. Was he afforded fair and due process? And then allow the federal court to dispose of the constitutional claims on whatever theory, substantive or otherwise, it needs to do. But that's only one constituency. I mentioned this court's concerns. In the past, Chief Justice Abramson, in her decision in Maris versus City of Cedarburg, talks eloquently about due process and specifically about the vulnerable nature of zoning decisions. It's localized. And what I take from that decision is that zoning is a local business. It's something that belongs in the state. And if you ask for the federal court to start mucking around with all the details of Chapter 68, I think you got a problem.
Yeah, but your whole thesis here is you leave it local, then you get into everybody knowing everyone, everybody having a personal financial interest. I'm exaggerating,
sure,
everyone, but people that in that you have people on the various zoning boards and committees and review boards who have property and have a personal interest, know everybody, and you get a situation which you're claiming here.
Correct.
People who had the power line their own pockets, and that the people who didn't have voting power did not. I mean, that's essentially what you're claiming.
Right, the ins versus the outs.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that is, so why are you going to keep it local? You ought to get it out of town and get it out of maybe the state.
Well, I'll tell you, from a practical standpoint, in this case, this gentleman liked to mine gravel. That's what he wants to do. He wants to do that. This wasn't about money to him. This was about being able to take his property, which is problematic farmland to begin with, get rid of the gravel, 10 years later, have farmland that he could continue to farm. That's what it was about with him. So there's a practical issue. Really, all he wants to do is focus in on getting that permit, which the Chapter 68 review is all about, which is different than a federal cause of action for civil rights.
But now you're reduced to a federal cause of action.
In the current situation, absolutely. And let me see if I can explain why I think it's a better policy. I would liken the approach that we suggest this court take on this question to how it has handled asbestos-related litigation. There's a recent decision from this court that basically says an asbestos-related plaintiff, somebody who's been injured by asbestos, has the ability to bring a second claim when a malignancy related to the asbestos occurs. And one of the reasons that this court used to justify that was to avoid having litigants, asbestos-related litigants, running to the courthouse for fear of claim preclusion and filing all kinds of anticipatory claims. And this court rejected that. And I would say the same thing applies here. If the goal under Northern States Power and claim preclusion is to avoid having protraction of litigation, expensive lawsuits, by inviting the joinder theory, I think you're in a situation where you do just that.
I suppose you could also argue that your client hasn't suffered any 1983 damages capable of being compensated or awarded in a Section 1983 action for damages until he has attempted to get his permit by all reasonable means, including certiorari.
I think you could make that argument. And certainly, I mean, let me give you an example. And I read with interest the court's summary that was published and set over on that podium this morning. And one of the things you talked about in the summary, the fact of the summary, is the 1997 permit application. Guess what they said? The defendants in this lawsuit, we talked about the 97 permit, and their response to it was failure to complete your state remedies. I think that's your point, Justice Sykes. And I don't think that necessarily is the case, again, with equal protection. In fact, I know it's not the case because the Seventh Circuit has said it isn't. But I think that's something that you can... Then you get into motions and arguments about that, and it just doesn't make any sense.
Is that really an exhaustion argument that would be made in a dismissal motion in the federal suit or a ripeness argument? And this goes back to some of the arguments that were made in the Thorpe case, but...
I think my understanding of due process is it requires that you plead inadequate state remedies. In other words, under the due process clause, setting equal protection aside.
Yeah, I'm focusing on equal protection. The issue of the adequacy of the remedy in a due process context is something separate from the issue of whether you have to exhaust your administrative remedies or whether your lawsuit is actually ripe for disposition.
Yes.
If we're focusing on the equal protection claim, which is, I think, what we're doing here.
Yes, I think you're correct. Yes.
I'd like to go back to an earlier point that was raised by the Chief Justice about the scope of certiorari. And it is a review that is limited to the record that was created at the administrative agency. But you don't mean to suggest by that, I don't think, that the general rules of civil procedure do not apply and that there is no ability to supplement the record to make out your case that the municipality violated one of the four certiorari requirements.
Is that suggestion that we could have availed ourselves of, for instance, the remedies under Chapter, or not remedies, but the procedures under Chapter 804, which is the discovery statute in Wisconsin?
Right.
I think the answer to that question is no. Because one of the things
the
that they...
The answer to the question is you cannot go outside the record. You don't take extra.
That's right.
That's your position.
That's right. Well, my position is that the procedures, whatever those procedures are governed by Chapter 68.
And where would you get that?
Well, let me see if I can find a site for you. One of the things that we see them argue in their case is that Sections 802.025B and 803.021, what I will generally call their joinder argument. They say that we could have brought claims pursuant to the civil procedure rules. Well, those statutes specifically talk about may, and I think that's an important point, not must. But then look at what 801.022 says. That's another statute that they cite. And that specifically says that certiorari is governed by its own procedures, if such procedures exist. I notice that I'm out of time. Would you like me to
finish? Answer that question, and then you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. I think you're looking at the Bershens case versus Town of Prairie to Sac.
Well, Bershens basically set forth the standard that it was contained within the record. My point is Chapter 68, if there were procedures, and there were procedures to be followed, those procedures dictated. We weren't thrown into the civil procedure statute, which is essentially their argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Good. Mr. Wiskowski, representing the town of Milton et al.
Hey, please the court. I'm Ted Wiskowski, and with me today is Meg Vergeron from our office, which is, as of January 1st, Staff and Rosenbaum, LLP. I join with the plaintiffs in one very important point, and that is a key policy determination that needs to be made here is how do we avoid protracted litigation? And what I would like to suggest to you is that if we want to avoid protracted litigation, we certainly don't do what happened here. Plaintiff has not had a day in court. Plaintiff has had a decade in court. This permit was denied on February 19, 1990. Since then, we had two certiorari actions, a full hearing on the merits, a court of appeals review of that decision on the merits. This court, you may remember, and probably it's so long ago that you have forgotten, this court denied their petition to review the court of appeals decision on the merits. And now we have a district court action which generates this. Surely we don't want to do this ever again. And there's no reason why it should have been. It should be the policy of the state of Wisconsin that everyone should bring their claims as soon as they can. The equal protection arguments we've argued were actually made. But if the remedies were ineffective, then a 1983 action should have been brought in 1990 in the first certiorari action. And had that been done, this case would have been over for at least 5 years. This case seems complicated, but it really is not. It is a joint.
I need to get a fact straight here.
Yes, sir.
My understanding of the record is that he first filed in 1989 or 1990, Mr. Hanlon did.
That's right.
That was turned down. And then the subject of this suit is a completely new request, isn't it?
No.
I mean, it's for the same thing, but it... that there was a renewal of a request 4 or 5 years later.
There was a conditional approval, which is not part of this case. There was a denial, which is this case and has been this case since 1990. The same permit application has been at issue since 1990.
And that's because he allegedly failed to meet the conditions, is that true?
That's right. He was turned down. There was a lot of opposition and so forth. I won't get into the merits either, but there was a lot of local opposition. But that's what we're dealing with. We are dealing with the same turn down, if that's a legal term, since 1990. As I was saying, the reason that this case now is fantastically complicated, and it really shouldn't have been. All claims should have been brought in 1990, and we would be done with it. He was allowed to bring, if he, he couldn't get a damage remedy in Chapter 68, no doubt about it, but he could get a damage remedy by bringing a 1983 action. And the joinder rules, which are cited in our brief, 80302 sub 1, 80202 sub 5 sub B, for decades, he could have brought that claim.
But it's permissive, isn't it? Joinder is permissive.
It's permissive, but if you do not join claims, the result, of course, is that you will be faced with claim preclusion on the end if the tests are met.
And
which
it would be removable
then to federal court. Well, that's a question which has just been raised, I think, for the first time here today. And I have a question about that. And if the court does, I would like a chance to address that, because I haven't heard that, and we'd like a chance to take a look at that. I have a question about that. We have not heard that before, nor have you, today, that it would be removable. But if it is removable, I don't see why that should cause a difference. I don't know why a defense lawyer would automatically run to federal court. I practice mostly in Madison, and that's certainly not the case. In Madison, it may be some places, but if it is, it's certainly not in the record. If we could talk about 6803 sub 9, we want to make our argument once again to make sure that it is clear. And that is, we believe that plaintiff certainly could make any equal protection argument that it sought to make within the context of the Chapter 68 proceeding. The language which is at issue here in sub 9 is difficult language because it contains at least two negatives, and it's difficult really to follow. And we looked at it long and hard in the office, and we're convinced that it's obvious, although it's difficult language, it's obvious what it means. And what it means is that if the case is not significant enough to implicate due process, then you can't have a Chapter 68 proceeding. You can't, for example, have a Chapter 68 proceeding simply because you don't like the decision. The rights involved have to be significant enough to implicate due process. And if they implicate due process, then you may bring a Chapter 68 argument, and you may argue whatever arguments you have that the determination is not according to law. Now, it really couldn't be any other way, because to accept the plaintiff's argument would lead to absurd results. You could, for example, have a Chapter 68 review, and the town could defend and say, the municipality could defend and say, well, you had opportunity to present all the evidence you wanted for as long as you wanted. You had the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses. You had the opportunity to bring all the exhibits that you wanted. You had all the process in the world. Now, we discriminated against you, and that's why you didn't get it. But you got all the process in the world, and therefore you couldn't complain about that in the Chapter 68 proceeding. It just makes no logical sense. Chapter 68 is statutory certiorari. And common law certiorari, the cases go on and on and say one of the key purposes of certiorari is to determine if the underlying body acted according to law. It is, in our view, preposterous to suggest that in a common law certiorari action, you could certainly bring an equal protection argument because you would be arguing that the body did not act according to law. But in statutory certiorari, it would be barred for some reason.
But counsel, how do you answer then the argument that if you allow this, that one of the purposes of 68 is to allow a fairly fast remedy?
Right.
And if we force an equal protection claim, a claim for money damages, in addition to simply getting the license, the permit in this case, that in effect you are really taking that taking that remedy, that certiorari remedy provided in Chapter 68, and making it something the legislature never intended?
Well, I think that the argument that plaintiffs make ignores the fact that this state is populated with excellent circuit court judges who can handle a case in a practical and logical way. And if it is appropriate to, if the court is looking at it, and if it is appropriate to send it back, then that circuit court judge, I'm sure, will have enough practical sense to say, we are going to wait for the resolution of that before we're going to proceed on your 1983 claim. There are, to say that we're going to be off and we're not going to be able to stop this runaway litigation is to say that if she sits on the bench, she is not going to be able to come up with a solution to avoid that, and it happens all the time. It's certainly not my experience. I had a large partnership dispute in which the circuit court judge said, this is a morass, and we're going to be doing this for years if we don't do it right. And he said, what we're going to do is answer the question about this contract first, then we're going to answer this question, and then if whatever the question is to that, we're going to go to the next question. And he found a very practical way to get at the litigation in an efficient and organized manner, completely consistently within the rules of Wisconsin civil procedure. And I may add, although there was much more at stake in that case than there is here, it started about 5 years after this one, and it ended about 3 years ago. It can be done. And so I think that the argument that we're all going to be litigating on parallel tracks and there's no stopping us demeans the circuit court judges out there, and because I think the court can have confidence, because they prove it every day, that they are competent professionals who can manage cases in an organized way.
Counsel, another question. I think you were here yesterday for that case, that Thornton versus Lebanon, so I assume you're acquainted with the Court of Appeals opinion.
I read it yesterday, yes.
As I understand, at least part of that opinion, said the Court of Appeals said that equal protection claims do not have to be brought, even if there is an adequate state remedy, and that they can be brought as a separate action. So that's, in fact, one of the issues in the case. Now, if we were to go the way you want us to go, would that require that we at least overturn in part Thorpe versus Lebanon?
I don't think so. I think that the issue in that case, actually, as I read it, and I heard the argument and went and reviewed it after the argument we did, is that what they were saying in that case is plaintiff had to exhaust the due process first, which was the argument. And there was, in that case, no initial state proceeding. There just was a out-of-the-box 1983 proceeding. And so first, the court was saying that you had to address due process. You don't have the exhaustion issue in equal protection, and I think that's what distinguishes what the Court of Appeals was saying in Thorpe, to our understanding.
Would you address the questions about the scope of certiorari review, statutory and common law, and whether there's any difference in the scope of review between those two and between the different varieties of statutory certiorari?
Well, Chapter 68 is specifically tailored to address specific issues in municipalities, and that's what they're talking about, permits and et cetera, but as far as the scope of the arguments that can be made, it makes no sense that they would be limited, and they weren't limited. Justice pointed out that the arguments were in fact made here. In the 1990 complaint for certiorari, plaintiffs complained that the result was arbitrary and unreasonable, obviously key factors in an equal protection analysis. In their proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law in 1990, they made basically the equal protection factual arguments they're making in this case. They proposed that the examiner find that substantial justice required that plaintiff be awarded a permit because he was similarly situated to three others who were awarded permits. If that is not an equal protection claim, I don't know what it is. The hearing examiner's 1994 order specifically addressed the unfairness claim that plaintiffs made about the some people getting permits and some not, and dismissed it, and that is what has been resolved on the merits. Even in plaintiff's brief in the Court of Appeals, on page 33 and 34, at record 44, exhibit 21, plaintiffs complained that plaintiff complained that he was treated unfairly in comparison to Mr. Clark and Mr. Frederick. I guess the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. You know, the plaintiff did make the same arguments that could, at least relevant to this case, that could be made in a common law certiorari.
Right. But there's a difference between what sorts of arguments you can make in a certiorari and what the standard and scope of review is, right?
Yes, but there does seem to be a conscious attempt to match 68 with common law certiorari.
And your position is that you can't? That the two are not equivalent?
In this case, we believe that they're functionally equivalent. The differences that may exist do not, in our view, exist in this case.
And what about the procedures that are available as a matter of civil procedure?
In what terms?
How you try these cases.
Excuse me?
In a certiorari action as compared to an action for damages.
More specifically, can you go outside the record and take additional discovery? Can you get testimony, evidence?
Supplement
come up
the
on
record.
The record, can you supplement the record?
You know, right. And there is not in Chapter 68 a procedure to apply the discovery rules, and that's correct. However,
wouldn't that make a big difference as far as how you're going to try your case if you're going to be limited to no discovery, or in other words, one, you don't have discovery, the other one, you do?
Well, that could be argued, but if I could just answer your question in just a second. First of all, it didn't make a difference in this case. This case has been an equal protection case from day one. Plaintiff has been complaining, you gave permit to these two people, and you didn't give it to me since the very first day, and that is what has happened. So this case didn't change. It could happen in some case, but it certainly didn't happen in this case. And then a second thing that could happen is that when the reviewing court sent it back for another hearing, I don't know why, consistent with the rules, plaintiffs could not have asked for certain things if they had an interest in them.
But what's the answer to the legal procedural question in the circuit court? In a certiorari action, statutory or at common law, can you supplement the record? Do the rules of chapters 801 to 847 apply?
You cannot change the record.
No, I'm not talking about changing the record. I'm talking about supplementing the record
right.
By testimony, affidavits, documentary evidence, etc.
You can't just put those things in, but I'd like to focus on... Excuse me?
Why not?
Because certiorari is limited to the determination made below.
Well, I know and that's why I'm talking about the difference between what sorts of arguments you can make to attack what happened below as distinct from how you go about making those arguments.
Okay.
Do you see what I'm saying? The distinction that I'm drawing?
I do.
Okay.
And I'd like to answer your question in the context of this case.
No, I'd like you to answer it globally.
Okay. Globally. the global answer is that the reviewing court looks at the record from below, and things cannot be added or supplemented.
And where does it say that?
That would be consistent with common law certiorari.
Numerous cases that say that.
Yeah. So that would be the same. So
the rules of the general rules of civil procedure, insofar as taking discovery, insofar as
freedom to put in any evidence you want in trying your case do not apply to either a common law or statutory certiorari proceeding.
I'm not sure in this case that that's correct.
Well, I'm talking about in any case, not just in this case, but in a Chapter 68 certiorari proceeding, in a Chapter 59 certiorari proceeding, in a Chapter 80 certiorari proceeding, as in the Burschen's case. Can you go outside the record to prove that, to prove up your certiorari standard of review?
At what point?
In the circuit court. When you're getting your
circuit at the circuit court decision level, you're relegated to the record,
and you can nothing make
nothing else.
Nothing else. So you attack that based upon arguments made in briefs. You can't put in any affidavits of anybody saying here's what really happened at the hearing, and doesn't appear in the minutes.
But that's what you should, that's the purpose of the hearing, to put in your evidence.
But doesn't it happen every day in certiorari actions that affidavits are submitted and documentary evidence is submitted to show what actually happened down below at the municipal court proceeding that doesn't appear in the record? And isn't that a factual, practical matter how these cases are litigated?
That's often the case. But
and what happened in this case?
Well, what happened in this case is important, and that, thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Now you have your chance.
What happened in this case is that the 1990 decision was reversed.
Right, and how was that litigated?
Excuse me?
How was that litigated in front of Judge Daly? Were affidavits put in? Was documentary evidence introduced to show what happened at the town level over and above what was in the record? Because my understanding is that the record was real limited.
I don't have any information that the record was expanded at that particular hearing. But what happened is that he reversed and sent it back, and that's my point. Now, this theoretical discussion about what difference would occur. Well, let me say this: we're having a theoretical discussion about what would occur if we had discovery. Well, we had discovery, and the district court dismissed their case. Is what actually happened. So in this case, it is extremely theoretical. But at the point, if plaintiff thought that they needed some additional
I'm going to have to interrupt you there, because it's got far more than theoretical application. It has very practical legal implications for this case, because if you cannot go beyond the record in a statutory or common law certiorari proceeding, then how can you litigate an action for damages under Section 1983 with it?
Well,
so I need you to answer that question. Case law or a procedural code go outside the record on a statutory certiorari or a common law certiorari?
Here's what you would have done in this case.
No, I'm asking you to answer the question. Is that standing up a straight yes or no? Can you do it? And if you can, tell me why under the statute for case law. If you can't, tell me why.
In this case, you're not going to go beyond the record developed below, but you could have developed the record below. Yeah, in 1990. Plaintiff had brought his certiorari claim and his 1983 claim. He could have done all the discovery he wanted if he wanted to, and when Judge Daly reversed, he would have had the benefit of all of that discovery to put in all of that information at the hearing which was held in 1994.
Okay.
So in this case, to say that plaintiff did not have the benefit of discovery had he followed the joinder rules is not correct.
Well, I'm thinking about this plaintiff, but also all the other plaintiffs out there who have complaints about how zoning boards act. And if they cannot, in connection with a certiorari action, go outside the record, and yet you're arguing that they must join a Section 1983 claim for damages with their certiorari action, which necessarily requires that more than the record be inquired into, then that's an inherently contradictory position.
I don't think, let's assume in 1990 that had been affirmed.
plaintiff would still have the opportunity to bring the 1983 action, and if discovery showed something different than it did, would have an opportunity for a remedy. That's one thing that could happen.
So you're suggesting that the two must be joined, and if you win on certiorari and the case goes back to the town, then the 1983 action is dismissed or it's stayed and pended until we find out what the town does and the case comes back up? What's the procedure?
Well, it depends on what the trial judge and the parties end up deciding or the trial judge ruling. If you have a 1983 action and it goes back to the board for a full hearing, which is what happened here, a couple of things could happen. One thing is that they say, "Well, how about staying the action so we don't do it?" If I were the plaintiff in this particular case, I would say, "No, I want my 1983 action to go forward because I want to do some discovery. I want to have the benefit of discovery when we have the hearing in front of the town board." I think the circuit court judges would say, "That's fine. Let's do that," and that gives the plaintiff precisely what he's complaining he couldn't get here. That's how you would do it. And there are many ways that you can do it, but to suggest that plaintiff wouldn't get the benefit of discovery, I think is just incorrect. In this case, and the fact is, plaintiff did get the benefit of discovery in this case and lost.
If you can join an equal protection claim, are you bound by the 30 days?
You would have to bring your action within that time or run some large risk. You could, if you were a risk taker, which predecessor lawyers perhaps were in this case to the firm that's here today, you could bring it and hope to amend within 6 months of the matter of course and have it relayed back. But you would, if you were prudent, you would bring all of your claims at once promptly within 30 days, which when people deal with municipalities, I think we are all used to very short time frames that need to be dealt with in terms of notice and so forth, and that is common.
What about if you're actually challenging the ordinance that's being administered? Can you join that as well?
The constitutionality of it or legality of it? I think that certiorari there are several cases that it's an action. Since it's an action, you can bring any claim that you have with it. And certainly, I think you could bring that claim as well.
Isn't there a statute that says you can't challenge the constitutionality of an ordinance in your suit? I mean, you're wrong. No? Okay.
But if you have a claim, then you can join that claim, is my point.
Well, if this is an action, then sections 801 to 847, all the rules of the Civil Procedure Code apply by virtue of 801.01, right? Which says, sub 2, chapters 801 to 847 govern procedure and practice in circuit courts of the state and all civil actions and special proceedings, whether cognizable as cases at law, inequity, or statutory origin, except where different procedures prescribed by statute or rule.
Well, you raise a good point. I mean, at the point, let's go way back to 1990, okay? What would have prevented plaintiff from asking, for example, for the deposition of whomever they wanted to do? And if the town board refused that, and you go up the cert in the civil action, the trial court, the circuit court, may well look at that.
Well, in my experience, that's how these cases are litigated.
Right.
If somebody wants discovery and
they ask for
it. Action, they
right.
take it.
Right, they ask
and
for
they
it.
Supplement the record to the extent that they need to prove up their case that there's been a violation of one of those four prongs of the certiorari standard.
The reason why I was limiting it is simply because if there's no ask, if it's not asked for, and if you have a determination and that's it, that's what you're going to be reviewing. But
So you're modifying what you said earlier, which was that you can't do that in a certiorari action,
except if you combine
it with an 1983, and then you can?
I'm sorry. The point I'm trying to make is that you review the record, whatever it is, and that is from below. And my point is that there are numerous ways that plaintiff could have gotten the information to make whatever record he could. And he did. Here. That's my point.
The record below you're talking
about. Right. Yeah, that's right.
Not the record in the circuit court, but the record below?
Yes, the record that the circuit court would be reviewing. Right.
So the case law that said that certiorari is a limited remedy and does not constitute a de novo review of what happened in the municipality below basically talks about the standard of review being very limited, the options for the circuit court as far as fashioning a remedy are very limited, and so forth, rather than referring to what sort of procedure is applicable in the circuit court for litigated complaints.
Correct.
Let me throw out, how do you distinguish then the Merkel case? The Merkel case says a writ of certiorari exists for limited purposes to test the validity of a judicial or quasi-judicial determination. The writ bears, quote, no resemblance to the usual processes of court by which controversies between parties are settled by judicial tribunals. Goes on, if you're familiar with that case, to indicate the only thing you have is the return, and the return consists of the facts of the record at the lower hearing, whether the facts that were, then the question for cert court is this, common law and statutory. Whether, and I just put in common law and statutory myself. The question for the cert court is whether the facts set forth in the return, excluding therefrom all matters introduced into it, not properly matters of record, justify the decision of the board, which was complained. Is that good law? Is that correct law?
Well, I'm not sure I'm hearing you completely, but the record is looked at. But what is the record? That's the point I want to make. You have an opportunity to make your record below.
What's below?
Below is at the town board level in this case.
Okay. He had an opportunity to make a record below. If he doesn't, and you do too.
Right.
Town to, okay. When you get up to the circuit court, can you add to that record? Can you add affidavits? Can you add testimony?
I appreciate
that. Can you get discovery?
Well, people do it.
That may be.
And sometimes circuit court
is that contrary to the case law of this state?
It does not seem to be consistent with it to me.
So the answer is it contrary to the case law? The answer is yes, it is contrary. Not only to Merkel, but to Bershens, which says we have a statute that talks about certiorari and gives you the opportunity to put in evidence you can do it. But under common law and statutory certiorari, which, at least as I remember the cases, but I could be proved wrong, courts is really the same. And you look at the record.
And that's my point. But you have a chance to develop that record
in the town
right.
board.
And a full chance here.
Right. And your position is they did develop the record in 90 and in 94, and you're willing to sit on that record. That is, have the court look at that record and say no equal protection.
They made the arguments there, and I'm not sure what you mean by sit
well,
on the
I
record.
Well, I mean that on the basis of the record before the town, that record is good enough to withstand an attack on equal protection. Is that your position?
Yes, it is, because if there was a violation of law which caused the determination to be what it is, they had an opportunity to put in evidence. If they failed to do so, so be it. And there is no evidence of a violation of protection.
They had to do it at the town.
That's right.
Just so.
Not only that line of question.
Yes.
You're saying they had to do it. I don't know. Well, somewhere buried in the middle of 68.01 is the following note. The remedies under this chapter shall not be exclusive.
That's right, and that is they would the certiorari action would fail if they had acted properly and joined the 1983 action. The 1983 action would still presumably be a lie. My time is up.
Yes, thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Good, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. They tell us that we could have argued equal protection in a certiorari proceeding. That said, I'd like to suggest the following hypothetical in answer to that. It is fortuitous in this case that Mr. Hamlin, Mr. Frederick, and Mr. Clark, fortuitous for them, that all of the equal protection problems erupted on the same night, February 19, 1990. Imagine if Frederick and Clark had their permits issued a day before Mr. Hamlin, or a day after. What does that do to Mr. Hamlin's 30-day right of review? I would suggest to you that 68 is about one thing, procedural due process, and it's fixed. It's the reason there's a 30-day review period, and the reason you have 30 days to file an appeal for municipal determination is because the due process component is fixed and specific to the individual. And that's a problem that they face. I'd like to touch on a couple other points that were raised. Under the removal statute, if there's federal jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, it can be removed.
Even though there's a state law issue.
Absolutely, because the district judge could remand the state law issue. That could happen under the supplemental jurisdiction.
Divide it out.
Right. But I think if that's the point, let's join all this stuff together. I think that gets away from their their fundamental argument, which is it's more judicially efficient to join them all together, and I don't think that's the case.
Well, as a practical matter, though, the federal court would most certainly remand a certiorari claim back to the state court.
I don't know if that's the case, Justice Sykes. Maybe certain district judges would do that. Others may not. I don't know the answer to that question. I'd like to point the court's attention to an admission that they make in a brief on page 13, where they say if there was no joinder, certiorari would be over in a few short months. I think that's right. I think that's what it's about. Okay? And that's the purpose of the proceeding, to be speedy and quick. Joinder inextricably alters the nature and scope of the remedy. And while they make much of the fact that you can bring a certiorari proceeding by summons and complaint, and it is now in action, they don't even mention Chapter 781, which says that when the legislature in 1981 made that change, nothing changed the nature and scope of the remedy. By adding a claim for damages as part of it, I think you do that.
What is your answer to the question about supplementation of the record?
At the trial court level?
Right.
Impossible.
Cannot do it.
Impossible.
How do you explain the fact that it's done all the time?
Well, I don't know if it's done all the time. I mean, Mr. Wiskowski's represented that to the court. It certainly hasn't happened in my practice. If we had adjoined a claim.
Why is it impossible? Is it 68.09 that makes it impossible? Whatever that section is dealing with remedies?
The reason I think it's impossible is certiorari is meant to be a review of what's come up from below. Whatever record has been developed within the process.
I put my finger on it. 68.09 sub 4, the right to present evidence and argument. The person aggrieved may file with the request for review. Written evidence and argument in support of the person's position with respect to the initial determination.
Right, and I would make an argument, Justice Babbage, to be just like an appeal to this court. We've got a record below, and we did that in this case. I mean, there were written briefs submitted, but that's a totally different animal than going out, as I said in my opening presentation, and sitting down with Mr. Frederick and having explained to me how it is he justified never complying with the zoning ordinance but coming away with economic benefits as a member of that zoning committee and developing those types of facts.
Let me ask you this. How would you prove arbitrariness, oppressiveness, or unreasonableness, or that the action of the administrative agency below represented its will and not its judgment if you weren't allowed to supplement the records? Because very often these records of municipal agencies are pretty
easy. I agree with that, Justice Sykes, and I think maybe is probably a comment more about the nature of the remedy than it is anything else. The reality of the matter is, in our case, we had no opportunity to supplement the record and add facts. and say, hey, what about this, and we're going to go do some depositions. That never happened. And I don't think Chapter 68 allows for it.
So the circuit court judge, both circuit court judges in this case never knew of the relationship between all of the various people?
Judge Daly certainly didn't. That is the first one. Judge Brood, I cannot recall off the top of my head whether or not it was introduced in briefs or not. I will say this.
So it was introduced just in briefs? It wasn't introduced in any evidentiary sort of a way?
That's correct. It was a general conclusion. A general argument was made about the unfairness of the fact that there were three permit applications using identical permits. It was unfair that two of them got it. But beyond that, there was no development of what kinds of facts and what things went down, and specifically, and most importantly, the motive at stake. And that's the issue. I see that I'm out of time.
That's right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Good. Thank you, Mr. Wiskowski. And that concludes our hearing in the first case.